very important session, which nevertheless remains kind of marginal to sociology more generally, despite the obvious central importance of science and technology in modern life. So what I want to do here is actually take seriously the question that I posed as a title for the talk, which I basically posed just as a way of initially being provocative to make sure some people would show up to this session, since I reckon there would be about 40 concurrent sessions occurring at the same time, which is correct. And that is knowledge well-governed, and how would we know? And the general point that I want to make here, in terms of what is it to take away from what I'm saying and what you might want to contest, is that there's a sense in which if one wants to talk about whether science is well-governed, the problem isn't that we don't know what the norms of science are. I mean, I think just about everybody who partakes of this discussion with some degree of concern about what it means for science to be well-governed and so forth, generally are aspiring to the same set of norms, at least at the verbal level. So we, Stephen Turner just ended the story with Robert Merton, and we can think about Robert Merton's four norms of science, right, the organized skepticism, the communalism, the disinterestedness, and the neutrality. It seems to me that at a certain level, everyone can agree on that. But then the disagreements start. So the question isn't what the so there's a sense in which the ideal is pretty clear in people's minds, and it's pretty clear in people's minds from a wide range of political perspectives. Okay, so for example, I mean, Stephen Turner's general story, a sort of general story he would be telling about expertise and the role of expertise in modern culture, right, sees it as this kind of ongoing struggle between liberals and socialists, where socialists are identified as authoritarian. Okay, and these people are all paying lip service to the same ideals. And that's one of the things that makes it easy for the ideals, as it were, to shift back and forth in terms of the ideological polarity. Okay. So if we're talking about the normative structure of science, the kinds of things that Robert Merton identified are in fact things that you can very easily find people endorsing from all kinds of persuasions. So there's a kind of universality to that, actually. What there isn't a universality to is, first of all, what are the ultimate ends and values that are served by those norms? Like, why do we like those norms? Why do we want those norms to be enforced? And that then relates to issues about what it is to be in the good society, right? The sort of larger questions about how are these norms of science being embedded in society, and that's where the liberals and the socialists and so forth disagree. But that's related to another question as well, and that's the question of, you might say, where are we now vis-a-vis those norms? So in other words, can we just read off these normative ideals of science from just the actual behavior of scientists as they are on the ground? Or rather, are scientists in some sense in a fallen state, right? They don't live up to their normative ideals. And so therefore, we need to intervene in some way to get them to live up to those ideals so then they can serve the ultimate end that science is supposed to serve. Okay? So there are these two kinds of issues here where radical disagreement will occur. One on what are the ultimate values and goals served by the normative structure of science, and where are we now vis-a-vis the enforcement of those norms? That's where the disagreement is, on those two issues, but not on the norms themselves. And that's why it was so easy for Robert Merton, without having to do any kind of ethnographic study or anything, just to sort of canvas, as it were, the history of discussion about the nature of science and find such uniformity among all kinds of people from, you know, time immemorial talking about what's valuable about science. Okay, so that's kind of where the issue is. And that's a very important sort of problem to raise from the standpoint of governance. Right, because when we're concerned about governance, right, we're concerned with, in a way, the kind of purchase that those norms have. That is to say, what do those norms promote in terms of the kind of society we want to live in, but also where are we with regard to those norms, because that will then have implications for the kind of regulation we might want to introduce to, let's say, plan science or monitor science or establish, you know, research ethics panels, things of that kind. Okay? So that's kind of where I think this issue is. And what I want to do is, in the remaining time, are you keeping track of time at all? Okay, so, sorry, I mean, so we have about 15 minutes? Okay. There are two separate contexts that I want to bring up here to address these two ways in which there's disagreement concerning the governance of science. The first one has to do with the ultimate values, the ultimate aims that science serves. Okay, and in the large book that I wrote on Thomas Kuhn, now published 5 years ago, which Stephen so kindly alluded to, and without knowing I would bring it up at the end of the talk, in chapter 2 of that book, I talk about a very important kind of crossroads issue. See, because there's a sense in which you can have a lot of people agreeing that science has been working very well and has been developing a lot of knowledge that's been very important and beneficial in all kinds of ways. But then there's always the problem of what happens once the science has matured. Right? Once the point that the science, as it were, has solved a lot of the problems that it set for itself, and there's a lot of hints that in fact this science could be quite useful and applicable, you know, to the world at large, through technology perhaps, but perhaps even by providing some kind of rational principles for governance more generally, at a more intellectual level even. And this was the state of physics as we get to the end of the 19th century, okay, where in fact a lot of people were beginning to believe that we had reached the, quote, end of science, and that it wasn't before long that Newtonian mechanics will have figured out all the puzzles that remain to be solved, and in fact you'd get the ultimate comprehensive kind of cosmology that's unified under a simple set of mathematical laws that are empirically demonstrable by various means. And so then there is a conflict begins to arise just at that period about then where do we go now that we've reached this highly mature state of science. Okay, and then this point is, what was the point of our having engaged in this project, at least from the 17th century onward, to promote science? Given that now science has become increasingly specialized, and to solve those remaining problems, we'll have to invest greater resources, and we'll in fact have to engage in more specialized forms of inquiry, the kind of practical benefits of it, of which will not be very obvious. So have we reached a point of maturity where maybe we should say, okay, science has reached a certain point, now we should move on to something else. We should try to apply it, not just keep the scientists rolling along. And so you then get a very highly publicized dispute that takes place in the beginning of the 20th century between Ernst Mach and Max Planck. Okay, both of them in the German-speaking world, both of them holding very prominent chairs. Mach, who is a trained physicist initially, has a chair in Vienna, but it's in the history of the inductive sciences. So this, you know, a chair in the history of science, essentially, one of the first in the world. And that's from that chair that the logical positivist then developed afterwards. And Max Planck is in Berlin, okay, and he's kind of the editor of the main physics journal in Germany at the time, the one that publishes Einstein's famous papers. And they're radically disagreeing on what the goals of science are. And the key thing is, of course, neither of them are anti-science. Both of them are pro-science. They both believe in the normative structure of science. But the question is, what is the point of science when placed in a larger society? Because that's going to determine how it's governed. And for Mach, at the end of the day, what science does is it alleviates drudgery. It's a labor-saving device. That the ultimate payoff of science is the way that it can be brought into technology for purposes of, as it were, economizing on human effort. So, for example, the way in which physical laws can be expressed in mathematical formulas, so we don't have to actually remember every observation, but we can actually encapsulate it in some kind of form. This kind of idea about science is a kind of instrument that economizes on our efforts, that, as it were, leaves us more room to think about the various things that we might pursue as human beings. That is, for him, the goal of science. And it is not an end in itself. It is a way of opening the door to the greater pursuit of human ends, allowing for more leisure, you might say, in contemporary terms. Okay? And that the payoff would be in the way in which it could be automated and mechanized, but what he didn't want was that there would be a priesthood of expert scientists, people who embody a certain mentality of science. So he thought that the best thing could happen is that science gets converted into technology, that mathematics becomes calculators. Okay? And that would then free up the space for you to do whatever you want with those machines, with those technologies. So Mach, in this respect, is kind of classical liberal in this idea, right? He's very pro-science, but he believes that science serves this end of allowing people to pursue whatever kind of ends they want. It is not an end in itself. Max Planck, on the other hand, right, has a view that is the idea being that, as it were, science will, by allowing science to be pursued as an end in itself, right, it becomes kind of the standard bearer of rationality in the society, And of course, there are many different ways of interpreting what that ideal is. Some is to say, well, everybody ought to be learning science, everybody should be scientized, the society should be scientized. One should adopt the worldview of science. There's a sense in which science brings with it a worldview that in a way sort of fully realizes what it is to be a human being. To be a real human being is to be a scientist. Now, some people have only managed to make it so far that way, but the whole idea is now that we're reaching the end of the road, everybody could be like that. Now, this idea has a very powerful impact, and it's easy to think about this in sort of, you know, authoritarian science planning kind of context, but it also has a very important idea, impact in the history of psychology, because the idea of the paradigm of human thought being the self-conscious reflections of physicists. In the early cognitive psychologies that were being developed in Germany in the early 20th century, some of these people who did this work were people who were originally trained in physics no less than Max Planck. And I'm thinking of Wolfgang Köhler, for example, of the Gestalt School. Okay? And these people, they took very seriously an idea that Max Planck put forward, which was that the idea that the physicist, in his thought processes, makes conscious what ordinary people think unconsciously. Okay, so there's a kind of very deep way in which one is to interpret this idea of the scientist as the full realization of the human being, right? It isn't just in this kind of authoritarian socialist kind of way, but it is also in this kind of deep psychological way of the physicist as a very self-conscious human being. Okay, and so the idea then is you want to promote science. You want to promote science, even very advanced, mature forms of science that have become very technical and specialized, as much as possible. And you want to spread that mentality that encourages people to go down that route as widely as possible, because that's the way in which they're going to realize their full humanity. So these are two radically kinds of different views about the ultimate end served by the normative structure of science. One of them is the kind of technological instrumental view, that science is allowed, frees up our time, frees up our mental space. The other is that science actually provides the fundamental worldview by which we become fully human. Okay, so these are two radically kinds of different viewpoints, but accept the same normative structure of science. Now the other, how much time do I have left, would you say? Okay. The other one is, in a way, a more down-to-earth kind of issue, you might say, one that I think is of more relevance to people who are concerned with empirical research, because there's a certain sense in which when one talks about the normative structure of science as an issue in social science or sociology, there's a tendency to think of it as something like a theoretical hypothesis, right? Namely, here's Robert Merton saying there are these form norms of science. Well, do they actually govern anything? What do they govern exactly? How would we show it? And this is the kind of the side of the issue that I want to address now. Namely, what is the relationship between the current actual empirical state of science and the normative structure of science? Okay. And what I want to argue here is that a good way of thinking about this is in terms of attitudes toward the legal system, about the set of laws that we have. What, you know, to what extent do actual people's behavior conform to the laws? There are two different attitudes that one might have toward this. And before I tell you what those attitudes are, I'll tell you the context in which I've been developing this, because this is relatively new work. I've got a book coming out early next year on new frontiers in science and technology studies. Assuming that the field science and technology studies exist next year, I'm trying to project into still farther future. I spent some time as a visiting professor in Copenhagen during the time of Bjørn Lomborg, who is a political scientist who wrote a book a few years ago now called The Skeptical Environmentalist, where basically what he did was he reanalyzed a lot of the statistical data on the basis of which the most pessimistic, you know, ecological prognoses have been made in recent times. And he's a methodologist by training, Lomborg, and basically sort of showed, well, these guys are overstating the case, you know, that in fact you can reinterpret the data in various ways, that in fact things don't look so bad, and that there are more important things to worry about than how many species happen to get extinct next week. Okay? And this caused an enormous amount of controversy. All right. On lots of different very interesting kinds of grounds. Because, for example, the book was vetted by the social scientists at Cambridge University Press, not the natural scientists, because it was thought that environmental science was a social science, not a natural science. Okay, so There are all those kinds of issues that apply. But what I want to draw attention to is the fact that in his own home country of Denmark, Lomborg was subject to criticism by a branch of the Danish Research Council, the main national scientific research council, called the Committee on Scientific Dishonesty, which is a kind of national research ethics panel of the ultimate sort. Okay. And maybe some of you have followed this in the press. It's gotten a lot of coverage in Europe. And it's gone back and forth, and the bottom line of it is Lomborg has been largely vindicated, and if anything, this research ethics panel has come under intense scrutiny and now is being radically reorganized. Okay, that's basically where it stands at the moment. But what I want to draw attention to is kind of two different kinds of competing ways, because there's a sense in which this Committee on Scientific Dishonesty operated on a certain kind of presumption about the state of science that is relevant to the argument here. And that is, they presumed that science is working well and normatively adequately until proven otherwise. So in other words, the nature of this panel was such that it only was brought into action when somebody brought up a complaint. Okay, so this is one kind of image you might have of the governance of science from an empirical standpoint. Namely, you presuppose that the normative structure, which we all, you know, in words uphold, is in fact being enforced, and it's only when people see that there is a problem and they bring it up to the court that there's anything to act on. Okay? And basically that was the case with Lomborg. Now, Lomborg, in his defense, and remember he's operating in this field called environmental science, is arguing that the kinds of things that he's being accused of being, as it were, politically biased, and this is causing him to interpret the data in certain ways, is in fact rampant in this field. This is de facto in this field, and he's being singled out unfairly. And so that a committee of this kind ought to, in fact, be monitoring the entire scientific field, right? And if they are really concerned about the kinds of issues that he's raising, ought to be taking principled action. And so they shouldn't just wait for a complaint to arise, but they should rather be acting in a principled fashion, that is to say, on the opposite presumption, namely that the scientists are guilty until proven otherwise. In other words, they're somehow falling short of adherence to the normative structure of science that they all officially pay lip service to. Okay? Now, in the legal system, we do have a way of recognizing this distinction I've just drawn attention to. And that is between a legal system that is accusatorial or adversarial on the one hand, right, where there's a sense in which we don't have a trial until someone raises a complaint, versus an inquisitorial system, whereby the judge, as it were, has free rein to initiate inquiries into areas where there's reason to believe that there is general malfeasance, and he can, as it were, expand the scope of inquiry as far as he wishes for purposes of dealing with the problem at hand. Okay? And it seems to me that most of these research ethics panels, when they start getting in the business of the governance of science, right, are of the first kind. Right? If there's no problem, you know, if I don't hear about it, there's no problem. Okay? And see, the reason why this issue really becomes quite vivid in the case of environmental science is because you actually have a lot of the, sort of more highly politically correct figures like Stephen Schneider, who are very, very much kind of the gurus of a sort of politically correct environmental science, actually saying quite openly in public, look, we do have to over-egg our claims. We have to overstate because that's the only way we're going to get money for our thing. So of course we go out of our way to exaggerate the problem. Right? Because otherwise, you know, if you just say, oh, well, there might be some problem 100 years down the line or 150 years down the line or something like that, people aren't going to take that seriously. They've got more immediate things to worry about at the policy level. But when you make it very vivid and you exaggerate and you look at the worst case scenarios and you do the worst extrapolations, then you can get people paying attention. Now, I say all this not because I say, oh, environmental science, therefore very corrupt. But the point is, there is an issue about what do you take to be the normative state of play in the field? What is normal in terms of advancing the frontiers of science, okay? And if the idea is, yes, we can politically spin things in this kind of field, this is taken as given, then one should acknowledge that, rather than just, as it were, victimize someone who ends up spinning it the wrong way. Okay? So this is kind of part of, so the issue of justice here, of, you might say epistemic justice, which is a term I've used before, kind of comes into play. So you've got these two kinds of systems, and what I want to say here in the remaining time is what the difference between these two kinds of systems look like as part of regulatory bodies for the governance of science. If you have an accusatorial system where you just start to prosecute a case once it's raised, then you presume that for the most part science is, first of all, pretty much what the scientists do, and second of all, that science is largely a self-correcting enterprise. In other words, within the system itself, right, whatever problems or errors or things get found out by the people involved, and you might think of the peer review process as kind of functioning in that self-correcting fashion, right? So in which case, the only time you ever really need to bring in an additional governance structure, right, is when the complaint has gotten so big that the internal mechanisms haven't been able to contain it. Okay. And also now, you have to think about then, what establishes the credibility of such a governance structure? If you're an accusatorial system, one of the things, of course, is going to be your neutrality to the parties involved, so that you're not partisan to the plaintiff to begin with or to the defendant, right? But also the fact that you have a kind of track record, right, in being able to provide restitution. Because if this is a complaint-driven system, then justice is going to come by redressing the damage that was alleged to have happened in the complaint. So some kind of restitution has to be made. That is to say, the party that's aggrieved has to be satisfied that justice has been served. Now, I raise all this because in the inquisitorial system, in the other system, there's a totally different kind of orientation there. First of all, you start with the assumption that science isn't necessarily represented by what scientists normally do. That there's a sense in which the normative structure of science may stand for an ideal that scientists in their more local environments and immediate incentives, right, are not encouraged to live up to. And you might think of environmental science as such a field, given the nature of the funding, the nature of the rewards, the nature of the content, all these things, you might say, kind of could, you know, as it were, just generally speaking, compromise the field. In which case, then, you want very strong regulatory activity on it generally, okay, regardless. And so then the question becomes, well, where does the source of credibility come for this kind of view? Well, a lot comes from having control over the purse strings, the funding mechanism. It doesn't make sense to be an inquisitor, right, unless you actually have some power to enforce your sanctions in a way that actually does damage to the people that you're inquiring into. Because if they can just go off into the private sector and do whatever they want, right, then the punishment is pure, you know, it's just a slap in the wrist. So that's one of the things. I mean, the inquisitorial system has to have full control over the resources so that they, in a sense, you know, there's something under threat here if they don't abide by the normative structure. And this is a big problem in having inquisitorial systems in the kind of devolved science policy regimes in which most developed countries live in today, where we're, in a sense, moving away from the possibility of having an inquisitorial regime because more and more of the science funding is in private hands. So if the government doesn't fund you anymore, you can always go to a corporate sector thing. Okay. And then, of course, then the value of having the inquisitorial system has to do with the fact that as the Inquisition is taking place, and you're actually looking into the normative structure of these fields, right, that there's a sense in which you're actually enabling scientists to live up to their own standards. You're actually adding value to the system. It isn't purely punitive, but there's a sense in which you're actually raising the level of the quality of the activity. That is the real value of having an inquisitorial system. We all pay lip service to the normative structure of science, but it's not happening on the ground. One of the values that can be performed by the inquisitorial system is that it enables and encourages scientists to live up to the system. And this has to do with the sanctions, no doubt about it. Okay, so all these things, in a sense, have to be in place institutionally in order for this kind of thing to work. Okay, and of course, independence is going to be very important. The other issue that I think is very important, too, is, and this is where it really contrasts with the Lombard case, is that if you have an inquisitorial system, your inquisitors and have to have an independent sense of what the normative structure of science is that isn't just dependent on scientific experts. And that independent sense can come from having done research on the social, you know, the social aspects of science and so forth, and understanding science and its long-term historical and philosophical dimensions. That is to say, an independent body of knowledge from which one, as it were, can evaluate, weigh the evidence, and so forth. The big problem with the Lombard case in terms of the credibility of the research council that was judging it was that it basically compiled already published papers about Lombard stuff that appeared in the media and all kinds of places, and it basically did a weighting kind of like by pounds. There was no attempt to discriminate, to evaluate, to show what mattered, what didn't matter, and what people were saying about this. There was no independent judgment that was brought in. And if you're going to have an inquisitorial system, that ultimately has to be the thing that there is a special kind of knowledge that you can add that can actually boost the quality of science. And in a sense, the long-term pitch that I would make here, and I'll end at this point, is that there's a sense in which people who are involved in the law and in the regulation of science, those legal mechanisms that are emerging and I think are going to become more important both locally and internationally in the coming years, they should develop their own bodies for understanding science and how it operates, and not to rely mindlessly on scientific experts. And in this respect, I think social scientists have a lot to offer here as a potential base of knowledge for these new regulatory bodies, which I think will come into being in the next few years. And with that, I'll stop. Thank you very much.
So we are moving from the test.